Thanks, Dennis. So the rivalry between the U.S. and China is the central inter-imperial conflict of our epoch. Trump has made this abundantly clear, especially over the last year, that he sees China as the main enemy of the United States in the world. He's made it totally clear in his national security documents. He's called for a shift from the U.S. imperial strategy, which had been the global war on terror, the so-called global war on terror, to now great power rivalry. And he's named China and Russia as revisionist powers that are a threat to American hegemony in the world system. Trump has also made the claim that China is undermining the U.S. economy and has launched this trade war with tariffs on half of China's exports to the United States. He's also confronting China on its attempt to move up the value chain and master 5G technology for the world system. And he's also escalating the conflict with China over the waterways of the Asia Pacific. But we should be clear that the confrontation with China didn't begin with Trump. This has been a long-term developing dynamic. It's not just a bunch of protectionists and nationalists and right-wing white supremacists in the White House, although they're escalating it. It's rooted much more deeply in the developments of global capitalism, the relative decline of U.S. imperialism, and the rise of China as an imperialist power in its own right. That's why there is actually a growing consensus in the U.S. ruling class about the need to confront and contain China's rise. If you read the business press, they're all up in arms about China. If you listen to the foreign policy establishment, they're all up in arms about China. And even inside the Democratic Party, you've got China hawks who are more aggressive against China than even Trump. So if you look at Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, he is an arch China basher. But it also extends to the liberal and socialist wing of the Democratic Party in the form of protectionism, represented by Bernie Sanders' arguments against China's threat to American jobs. Trump's solution to the U.S. crisis of imperial strategy is what some have called illiberal hegemony. A commitment to maintain U.S. dominance of the world system while abandoning multilateral cooperation for an America first unilateralist nationalist strategy. Applied to China, this has meant the launching of what some are now calling a new Cold War. Now, this is the last thing the U.S. wanted coming out of the last Cold War, that is to see the rise of a potential great power rival. The entire strategy of U.S. imperialism after the end of the old Cold War was to superintend a neoliberal world order as the world's only superpower. It aimed to incorporate the rest of the world states into that order by force, or by pressure, or by enticement. That is, they wanted to oversee a world global capitalist system. And its military has been used to crush so-called rogue states who resisted that process of incorporation and contain crises created by neoliberal policies like structural adjustments or the destruction of national economies by opening to the world market. Countries like Haiti that have been under relentless occupation by the U.S. state and by the U.N. proxies. Throughout, the U.S.'s main goal was to prevent the rise of a peer competitor, a new superpower rival. Three developments in the world system undermined this grand strategy. First, the neoliberal boom, which began in the early 1980s and ran up to 2008 and the Great Recession, fundamentally changed the way world capitalism operated. That is, new centers of capital accumulation started to develop in the world system as a result of globalization. China, in particular, is the most important emergent economic power. It transformed itself from a small percentage of the world economy to now the second largest economy in the world, and really the workshop of the world, and increasingly going up the value chain to challenge the U.S. in its areas of dominance, especially in high-tech research and development. And these states, China most in particular, as they've increased their power, have become more assertive. The U.S. The second factor that changed the situation was the U.S. suffered what General Odom called the greatest strategic disaster in U.S. history. That is, they lost the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and as a result has set them back in their capacity to dominate other corners of the world system. So the third element that changed the situation for the U.S. was the Great Recession, which hammered the U.S. economy in particular hard, and it got out of it through a strategy of austerity and stimulus, but has not been able to generate a new prolonged boom in the U.S. economy. We have an ongoing expansion, but it's a sluggish expansion in which they have not really restored expanded reproduction of the U.S. economy. China, by contrast, conducted, I think, probably an even larger stimulus after the Great Recession that reinvigorated, at least for a while, its massive growth rates. That has compounded some of its problems, which I think are beginning to come home to roost. That is a problem of debt, overcapacity, and that those conditions are creating a slowdown where the Chinese economy, which had been growing at double digits, is now around 6.2%. The result of these three developments has led to the relative decline of American imperialism. It no longer oversees a unipolar world order, but an asymmetric multipolar world order. It remains the dominant imperial power in the world system, but it now faces, if you read anything that the policy establishment is writing, a rising competitor in China and a host of regional powers that it's less in a position to dictate and control as it had been after the end of the Cold War. In this context, China has taken advantage of the relative decline of the U.S. to assert itself as a rising power. And Xi Jinping, in particular, since his rise to the leadership of China in 2012, has been very deliberate and out front about it. He abandoned the very cautious foreign policy of his predecessors, and he's now proclaiming a launch of a new Chinese dream of asserting China to its rightful position as a world power and overcoming its century of humiliation at the hands of the United States, Europe, and Japan. What they've aimed to do is to try and assert its domestic strength in the international economy, especially through One Belt, One Road, which is a $1 trillion infrastructure investment program that hopes to make China the hub of the Middle East and Eurasia, really, the whole and down into Africa. And it has contracts that it has even beyond those zones, even into the U.S. Dominated hemisphere on our side of the globe. They also want to rise up the value chain through the China 2025 initiative, in which the Chinese state is backing national champions, either directly or indirectly, like Huawei, to dominate, especially in high-tech research and development, especially 5G, which for the next phase of both commercial and military competition is going to be of decisive significance. If you read, there was a recent Defense Department document that came out that explicitly calls for a Marshall Plan so that the U.S. can compete against China in 5G technology, because they see themselves as falling behind. China has also projected its military power in the waterways of the Asia Pacific, building up its navy, establishing military bases on islands in the South and East China Seas to control shipping ports and also lay claim to undersea oil and natural gas reserves and to claim rights to the fisheries in those sections of the Asia Pacific. Finally, it's been much more assertive than in the past in international politics. The U.S. decline and China's rise has thrown American imperial strategy into a quandary, because it's not the situation they anticipated, a rise of a potential rival. It faces this rival that it's profoundly integrated with, and that's what's created a set of political contradictions as well as economic contradictions. Its multinationals use China as an export processing base, which obviously makes competition difficult, because if it's your main geopolitical rival and your multinationals are using China as an export processing base, it makes that conflict confusing and contradictory. China also holds vast currency reserves of U.S. Treasury bonds, which led Hillary Clinton to say, how do you deal with your competitor toughly if it's your banker? So you can get a sense of the contradictions that U.S. policy has confronted. Before Xi's assertion of Chinese power, the U.S. policy had been a combination of containment and engagement. Some people call it congagement, is a funny neologism that political scientists use. The U.S. aimed to incorporate China and pressure it into abandoning its state ownership of sections of the economy and force open the Chinese market to American multinationals. So as a result of that double-sided policy of congagement, you've seen contradictory shifts back and forth between one pole, either containment or engagement, back and forth. Bill Clinton began this policy really in the early 1990s, calling China as a strategic partner, that is, and he really was pushing for the China to join the World Trade Organization. When Bush came to power after China's accession to the World Trade Organization, he redefined China as a strategic competitor. But soon, and if you look at a lot of what Trump has started to do, Bush was already beginning to move in that direction, but then he got waylaid in the disastrous wars in the Middle East, disastrous for everybody involved, especially the Iraqi and Afghan populations. Obama was really the last gasp of this engagement strategy. He shifted the emphasis dramatically towards containment of China's rise with the so-called pivot to Asia, which had a few planks to it. His aim was to wrap up the catastrophic interventions in the Middle East and reorient U.S. imperialism on containing China with the pivot to Asia. These are the three dimensions. Economically, it aimed to incorporate Asia on American terms through the neoliberal Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and isolate and pressure China specifically around the question of state ownership of sections of its economy. Militarily, Obama wanted to reorient 60% of the U.S. Navy out of the Middle East and over to the Asia Pacific. And politically, he aimed to shore up and expand the network of alliances that the U.S. has overseen since World War II, specifically to contain and push back against China. But that pivot failed. The U.S. failed to extract itself from the Middle East. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement went up in flames, and the Asian alliances frayed that the U.S. has because they kept being pulled into the orbit of China economically. So Obama's policy really has failed. Trump has introduced a new strategy of illiberal hegemony, as I called it, to solve Washington's imperial crisis. Now, he's a nut, frankly. I mean, we should be honest. We're led by somebody who thinks the American military occupied airports during the American Revolution. I mean, like, that's what he said in his absurd speech that he gave in front of tanks. But anyway, the elements of rationality in the Trump administration has a clear policy that they've laid out in various policy documents. First, to shore up the domestic security state by policing borders and surveillance of oppressed people, especially immigrants and Muslims, but that is increasingly turning to include Chinese scientists, and we should talk about that because there is a crackdown going on in American universities of Chinese foreign students and Chinese grad students because the U.S. state fears that they could be stealing intellectual property and giving it to the Chinese state. Second, Trump has made it very clear he'd like to onshore American manufacturing and protect American supply chains, including to encourage them to leave China to go to countries more in the U.S. orbit, especially Vietnam of all countries now in the U.S. orbit. It's shocking to think about. Third, they wanted to shift from the war on terror to this great power rivalry and build up their defense budget, specifically in the weaponry that targets China. Fourth, they want to put America first as their central policy and move away from the multilateral policies towards transactional relationships with everybody, from China to the European Union. Applied to China, this new imperial strategy is making the U.S. move into this new Cold War with Beijing. In economics, Trump is trying to do battle with China by whipping up this trade war, as I said, putting tariffs on half of China's exports to the United States. The aim is to stop forced technology transfer, protect American intellectual copyrights, crack up state capitalist industry, and open up Chinese markets to the United States, and stop China's state support for national high-tech champions like Huawei. In politics, Trump is trying to pressure American allies to ban Huawei, especially because it fears that the Chinese state will use the 5G technology to spy on states and people. And they want so they're trying to buy that, prevent the 5G technology from Huawei being used by American allies. Almost done. They're also trying to shore up alliances state by state against China. And in military, he's building up the defense, especially the Navy, and increasing naval patrols in the Asia Pacific, and selling weapons to all sorts of historically antagonistic states to China, like Taiwan. All of this is escalating tensions with China. They may cut a deal, because the trade deal, it looks like they're going to cut a deal. They may not cut a deal. They may cut a deal. It goes back and forth at various summits. But none of those deals will resolve the underlying conflict, which I expect to escalate in the coming period. So this is going to be the central inter-imperial rivalry and a real test for the international left about how we respond to it. Before I talk about that in conclusion, just want to say this is the rivalry, but its tendency to turn into bigger conflagrations is mitigated by the fact that both of them are nuclear-armed states, so there's a threat of nuclear war if it escalates into greater tensions. They are globally integrated, which again mitigates against it becoming a classical inter-imperial rivalry, and so they're reluctant to escalate the thing, but there's a trajectory in the conflict. So all of this, as I said, is going to test the left internationally, and our viewpoint should be really clear. As people in the United States, we have to oppose American imperialism first and foremost. It is the biggest bully and enemy of people's liberation all around the world. But that in no way is the end of our task, because you have rising rivals and especially China that are also imperialist powers. If you look at what One Belt, One Road is doing in Africa, this is imperialism in economics. And if you look at some of its other bullying tactics towards states in the rest of Asia, you have a similar kind of imperialism. So our allegiance should not be with the Chinese state against the American state. Instead, our allegiance has to be between American workers and Chinese workers in a common international struggle against both states in this rivalry. And that's the hope and strategy in politics of international socialism.
Thank you, Ashley. I really appreciate it. For those who are kind of along the margins, there are open seats. So people have an open seat. If you could put your hand up, and people who want to take advantage of a chair, please do so. Next, we have Elaine Liu. She is a program officer at the China Labor Watch. It's a New York-based NGO advocating for workers' rights in China. The China Labor Watch conducts undercover investigations into the factories of multinational companies and places pressure on the companies to improve working conditions, and also educates consumers on labor rights issues. So please welcome Elaine.
Hi, everyone. So today I'm just going to be talking a bit about the labor movement in China, looking perhaps in the past 10 years. So I have three parts in my talk. The first part, I'll be looking at some of the notable strikes, protests, and collective actions in recent years. And the ones I mentioned actually highlight the evolving nature of labor struggles in the country, which also aligns with the changing economic landscape in China as well. And the second part, I'll be looking at the role of unions briefly, and the recent repression of labor NGOs. And finally, I'll be looking into the future of the labor movement in China. So China moved towards creating a very business-friendly environment for private enterprises in the reform and opening up period. We've all heard of China's unprecedented economic growth, but this has come predominantly at the exploitation of workers. So let's just a brief note about the central government in this. So they've enacted various labor laws to address rights abuses, but local governments are hungry for overseas investment and maintaining economic growth. So they've subsequently failed to implement these labor laws. So it's against this backdrop that workers toiling in these factories have had no choice but to take collective actions to fight for their rights. So let's look at 2010. It was a year of labour unrest in China. Low wages had long plagued the manufacturing sector. So as workers flocked to factories established in southern China, their wages were not sufficient and didn't keep up with the rising commodity prices. So in 2010, workers at the Nanhai Honda factory in Foshan went on strike with a series of demands which included a wage increase. And they eventually won this. And this was despite their current wages being at the minimum wage of the region. And the strike also set off several strikes in other automaker and electronics facilities across the country. And notably, this came at the heels of a slate of suicides at Foxconn, which also saw the company increase wages. So let's fast forward to a couple of years. Production costs are starting to increase, wages are rising, and factories are beginning to relocate inland or to other developing countries. But factories are failing to give workers any or sufficient relocation compensation. So with the risk of being laid off, some of these workers who have been working at this factory for many years are beginning to see the effects of not having the employer making social insurance contributions. And so these factors all contribute to the 2014 strike at the Lidare shoe factory, where workers won several concessions, including relocation compensation and payment of social insurance and housing provident fund arrears. The workers from Lidare actually sought assistance from the Panyu Migrant Workers Centre, a local labour NGO, and they actually assisted workers in electing representatives, providing legal assistance and consolidating the demands. And this actually led to staff at the NGO being assaulted or detained over the course of the strike. So China has been moving towards a service or consumption-led economy. So whereas the manufacturing industry was beset with strikes and protests in the early 2010s, we're beginning to see this spill over into the service industry in recent years. So in 2016, we saw a coordinated strike in Walmart stores across China against the working hours system. And this was a rare instance where workers were organising across the country, mainly online. In 2018, so last year, we saw truck drivers go on strike due to increasing fuel costs, arbitrary fines and declining orders. And thousands of truck drivers participated in cities around the country, predominantly because a logistics platform group had begun implementing a system that forces workers to actually bid for freight orders. And of course, the lowest bid is always accepted. So food delivery drivers also went on strike last year because of issues such as cuts in pay, delivery times, high accident rates. And the competition between several food delivery companies had chipped away at workers' take-home pay. So both these incidents show the effects of the rise in the gig economy, where workers who are self-employed in China don't receive any protection, especially from the labour contract law. And finally, this year, tech workers protested against the 996 work schedule in the industry, where workers regularly work 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. So the domain name 996.icu, which means if you work 996, you'll be sent to ICU, was launched listing labour rights laws and blacklisting companies that implemented the 996 work schedule. Activists submitted information disclosure requests to the government and sent Jack Ma, Alibaba's founder, copies of the labour law. So just a brief word about unions. So where do the unions come into play in all of this? So the strikes that take place in China are all wildcat strikes. So there is only one union in China, the All China Federation of Trade Unions, which functions as more of a bureaucratic arm of the government. Mm-hmm. They don't organise strikes, collectively bargain on behalf of workers, and they actually take on more of a role of a mediator between workers and management. So in the Honda strike I just mentioned, the union officials actually tried to force strikers back to work. Over the years, the union has made attempts to reform. For example, they've rushed to try to increase membership. But this has really deviated from the goal of actually representing workers. And a lot of these workplace level unions are mere formalities, and workers generally know very little about them. So grassroots labour NGOs have played an integral role in advocating for workers' rights. Labour NGOs, they provide legal assistance, facilitate trainings, conduct policy advocacy, despite working in a very precarious environment. Many activists have been questioned, harassed, and detained for their work over the years. So two crackdowns in recent years show the Chinese government's growing intolerance towards labor NGOs and, to be honest, civil society in general. In 2015, Chinese authorities launched coordinated raids detaining dozens of labor activists and NGO staff across Guangdong. Many were released after their detention. Three prominent labor activists were ultimately handed suspended sentences, with one serving 9 months in prison. They're all charged with gathering a crowd to disrupt public order, notably for their role in the Lide shoe factory strike, which was mentioned before. And the four of them were staff of the Panyu Migrant Workers Center. So this clampdown clearly had a chilling effect. Labor NGOs scaled back on activities, went underground. Some transformed into community organizations deemed acceptable by the government. And the second crackdown I'd like to mention is an ongoing crackdown. And it began the summer of last year when protests broke out at Jasic Technology, a welding machine manufacturer, after several workers attempting to unionize were laid off. This galvanized into a movement after Maoists, Marxist students, retired party officials expressed solidarity with workers at the factory. And the group was met with brutal repression from the government, with many students, workers, staff from Maoist organizations, NGOs still detained today. And the crackdown continues, and those with no relation to JASIC have been swept up. In late January, five NGO activists in Shenzhen were detained. And we've also seen staff from anything from public interest to social organisations all fall victim to this crackdown. The scale of the JASIC incidents has clearly alarmed the government, especially with the large number of leftist students involved, creating this worker-student alliance. Many of these students were from Marxist societies established at prestigious universities such as Peking, Renmin University. And the involvement of these students actually pushed the struggle to become more political in nature, as they embraced ideas of Mao and Marx to highlight inequality and to support workers in their struggle. And furthermore, with this economic downturn, it's made the government wary of worker protests and those who may potentially play a role in providing guidance to these aggrieved workers. So what can we expect from the labour movement in China, given these crackdowns on labour NGOs and this continuous blatant violation of workers' rights? Firstly, on the role of unions. The union has attempted to push for reforms over the years, with President Xi Jinping calling the union to focus on employees. But this also includes gaining the trust of workers through genuine representation, being attuned to workers' needs, taking steps to address any exploitative practices before wildcat strikes have to take place. And so I would say I hold a rather pessimistic view regarding the union in China and find it hard to see them as being effective in representing workers' interests in the near future. And actually, prior to Xi Jinping, the All China Federation of Trade Unions actually took greater strides in their reform efforts. Secondly, a comment on the US-China trade war. We can expect many factories to begin shifting overseas, searching for cheaper labour, and this will no doubt affect workers. So I just read the other day that Apple was considering, you know, shifting 15 to 30% of their production facilities outside of China. Despite being one of the most profitable companies in the world, if they're unwilling to absorb the cost of these tariffs, then what is that to say about smaller companies or factories that are even less profitable? Mm-hmm. So we can most likely expect layoffs, relocation of factories, and these are factors that will most likely cause worker protests, strikes in the foreseeable future. So finally, just one final word about the labour movement in general. So all these strikes, collective actions that have occurred over the years and that are still happening now, they haven't had the participation of labour NGOs. So despite the crackdowns in recent years and the shrinking space for these NGOs to work in, this isn't going to stop workers mm-hmm. from taking to the streets. We've seen these collective actions starting to erupt in inland provinces where labour NGOs weren't traditionally set up. So it's just impossible for the government to stop these protests from happening, because they're happening almost every day. And especially with censorship in China, a lot of these workers are unaware about the extent the government will repress these sort of actions, so they are more willing to take these risks to participate. If the government, factory bosses, companies continue to fail to address the needs of workers, they really have no choice but to take collective actions to fight for their rights. especially if they feel they've exhausted all possible means to have their demands addressed. So we can really only expect to see more and more of these workers' struggles, and I hope we can continue to express solidarity with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. Very much appreciated. Our final speaker and the panelists before we get to the discussion is Kevin Lin. He is an activist and researcher of China's labor movement. He's worked to build international labor solidarity between Chinese and American workers and activists. He coordinates the China program at the International Labor Rights Forums in Washington, D.C., and co-edits the journal Made in China. So people should definitely check out that journal, and that journal deals with labor and labor rights in China. So please welcome Kevin.
All right, so sort of to follow up on those two talks, my talk is going to be mainly focused on what we on the American left, on the US left, could do in relation to the US-China rivalry. I have been an activist and researcher of China's labor movement for many years, and have been involved in a lot of the international labor solidarity work with Chinese workers and activists under repression. But increasingly, I'm turning more and more of my attention to the issue of U.S.-China rivalry. This is, of course, not a new concern, but the U.S.-China trade war, which is only superficially about trade and really about inter-imperial competition, has made it very urgent for all of us to think seriously and purposefully about this issue and what we can do here in the US. And this requires us not to treat China and the US-China rivalry as an afterthought, but be proactive and thoughtful about what to do. And I want to add that the U.S.-China rivalry, is certainly not an afterthought in the mind of most of Chinese people. It's still within living memory that United States supported the right-wing Nationalist Party in the Chinese Civil War against the Communist Party in the 1930s and 40s. And we had more than two decades of containment and hostility from successive U.S. administrations toward China after 1949. And of course, there was the Korean War, where there was actual military confrontation between the United States and China. So it is very much within people's memory that those conflicts are not something new. If the U.S.-China rivalry here feels really new for many people here in the United States, it is because we have forgotten history. So in my talk, I would like to focus on three tasks that we, by which again I mean the left in the US, and I very much call myself as part of the US left, what we can do and what we should do with regard to the US-China rivalry here in the US. And I sort of focus on three interlinked tasks. The first one is clarify our perspective from the left on China. What we think Chinese is, the nature of Chinese state and Chinese society, what China does, both inside China and internationally, and how we should respond to what China does. And this is not only for analytical purposes, it is important for developing this left perspective is important for building some shared views and perspective on the US left and for shaping how China is discussed in the United States. The second task is that once we have a shared, broadly shared perspective on China, a critical task is to engage with the US left broadly, but also with the US public, and shape the public discussion on China here in the United States, which is very, very challenging, but very urgent. Because absent of very progressive perspective and progressive perspective on China here in the US, we gave the space and the field entirely to the Republicans, who are obsessed with trade discussions and intellectual property for the corporations and national security, and also to the Democrats, who have very little progressive to offer on the question of China. Mm-hmm. And finally, very much relating to the first and second tasks, is that the one way to engage with the US public is by building international solidarities with China's social movements. Mm-hmm. And that includes labor movement, but also feminist, LGBTQ, and environmental movements, etc., etc. And this task is very self-explanatory. It's very basic, but it's still very, very important that we do it well, and we do it more. And I will discuss some of the solidarity efforts and public engagement that we have done in recent, in the last couple of years, and which I think deserves greater efforts by all of us here in this room and more. So let me talk about the three tasks in turn. So the first task is to develop develop and clarify our perspective on China. So you will be very hard pressed to find a lot of really good public writings about China from a left perspective here in the United States. You know, Ashley is one of the people who has done a lot of really good writings on US-China rivalry, but you know, if you look around, there's really not a lot of that public accessible writing and analysis of China from left perspective. This is especially jarring comparing to the volume of analysis of the Soviet Union by the left during the Cold War. Of course, there are many reasons for the difference, for the contrast, but we are at a point where we are so behind in thinking and analyzing China and US-China rivalry from the left, given the seriousness of the issue. So we need to develop a shared perspective on China that is critical of the Chinese state and capitalism, that is opposed to the US-China rivalry, not supporting either the American or the Chinese state. Just comparing to the US-Soviet Union rivalry, we now had the advantage of not having too many people on the left defending the Chinese state, although you'll be surprised to see some people still defending the Chinese state and thinking it's a socialist state. This is because, you know, for most of us on the left, we do not think the Chinese state is socialist, and we do not think it's the Chinese state is worth defending against the capitalist West. But we should also equally be on guard against those who support the American state, mm-hmm, against the Chinese state, simply because the US is democratic and China is authoritarian. Mm-hmm. I think the nature of those societies should not change our view of or position on the US-China rivalry. And of course, we can always point to a lot of examples. You know, Elaine has pointed to some of the examples, and actually to the Chinese government, you know, repression and violation of workers' rights and not the rights of other minorities. So we should you know, we need to accept that, and we also need to accept that sometimes we may share the same concerns as conservatives and liberals, such as issues on issues such as Xinjiang and Hong Kong, just to take two recent examples. So in the case of Hong Kong, you know, there's an argument on the left, on the US left, still maybe a minority position, maybe only by a few people on the fringe. But there's a still view that because, you know, some political parties and activists may have been given funding or given support by US political groups, therefore the recent Hong Kong demonstration that saw up to, you know, a million people on the street is somehow a CIA coup or CIA plot or conspiracy, you know, rather than reflecting the mood of the Hong Kong people. Right. You know, when you have a city of 7 million, essentially one in seven people were on the street on that day. Mm-hmm. It's somehow not reflecting that mood. It's a plot by a few groups. In the case of Xinjiang, again, because of the mainstream interest in the issue of internment and concentration camps, and because it's not easy to get good first-hand information on what's happening there because of the very tight government control in the region, there is a risk to either overlook or minimize the seriousness and the scale of what's happening in Xinjiang in terms of interning, you know, restricting the physical the physical movement of the Xinjiang the sort of Muslim minorities. And for the left, it's entirely legitimate to be concerned over the same issues sometimes as the mainstream groups or even some conservative groups. It's not having the same concern per se that is the problem. It is how we could develop a left perspective and solution that would be the challenge that goes beyond some of the mainstream reporting or discussion. And again, you know, we have not done this very well in general. The second task and third task are sort of come hand in hand, that is to engage with the US left broadly and the public and building solidarity with social movements in China. So first of all, who are our audiences? That of course includes all of you, the people on the left in the US, who identify as leftists in the US, American unions, progressive groups, but also Chinese international students that we very often study in the US, who we often very often overlook. Again, I think there's a sometimes explicit and sometimes implicit assumption that because those students, the fact that they are able to afford to study in the US, they must be from a very privileged background in China, therefore they must be very conservative. And again, we're not going to deny there are students who are conservative, but it's simply not true that everyone thinks the same among the Chinese international students. And increasingly, and then it's, just talking from my own personal experience, we have more and more students who come to the US for graduate school who were activists in China. And, because of the repression, they had to essentially, or they chose to come abroad and study because the repression is so severe inside China. So you have at least a small group of people among the Chinese students that I think we should definitely engage and speak to, rather than assume that they are conservative, therefore we shouldn't even bother to talk to them. So let me share a few ways in which we on the left should engage with the left and the public in the U.S. And build solidarity with workers and other social movement, worker struggle and other social movement in China. The first is something that we have done, all through the years and more so recently because of repression, is that by building solidarity with Chinese activists under repression, and in the process building networks of concerned activists here in the U.S., putting people in touch and sharing and discussing what we could do. The most recent solidarity effort has been around the GSEC case. Mm-hmm. As Elaine mentioned, the GSEC case has been going on for almost exactly a year. It sort of broke out in July 2018, and the first arrest took place in late July, I think, and there were several waves of arrests all through the late 2018 and well into the first half of 2019. So we have worked with academics, students, activist groups, and unions here in the US to raise the issue of labor repression in China, and gave attention to the arrested activists and workers in China. It has been challenging because of the scale of the repression and also the links. It's a lot easier for us to organize solidarity if if it happens once, but if it continues and there are several waves, it's been 6-7 waves since mid-July last year, it has been a really real challenge to keep up the solidarity effort. In this I should say, the DSA has been very responsive. Mm-hmm. When we asked them to issue the statement of support, the National Political Committee very quickly endorsed a petition and unanimously to offer support for the GSEC activists and ask for their release. But at the same time, I think we also need to think about how we can move beyond just really good gestures. Mm-hmm. It's great to sign petitions and issue statements, and I have, I myself and many others have done exactly that. We organize petitions, but so certainly don't get me wrong. I do think there is a lot of value in petitions in terms of giving attention and educating people in the process. But we should also think about what else we could do that goes beyond issuing statements and signing petitions, etc., etc. And we also should think about how we can move beyond this kind of firefighting work, right? So there's a repression. We scramble to find some way to support activists at risk. So there are a few things that we have begun to do, and I will share with you very briefly. First of all, this we have been, many of us have been doing more and more public writings about China. Again, it's going to the point of that there is really not a lot of really good public writings from progressive perspective on China. And so we have been doing a lot of writings, but also work with, for example, Haymarket to publish books and translations written by activists in China, and I just refer two books that published by Haymarket over the last 3 years. One is called China on Strike, and the other one, Striking to Survive, which are both on sale upstairs. So those are books are written in Chinese, originally in Chinese, by labor activists based on very extensive interviews with workers and worker activists. So they have been translated, they were translated into English and were published by a Haymark book, and they really drew you into the sort of the stories and perspective of workers and activists. So it's very, very valuable, and we hope Haymarket will continue to do that, and we certainly hope other publications will continue to publish on China. Second thing is bringing activists from China to the U.S. To meet with the activists and unions here in the United States. So it used to be more accessible for American activists to visit China and meet with activists in China, but that has been getting very, very difficult because of the surveillance of activists and repression in China. So we have tried to bring Chinese activists to the U.S. And we have, for example, worked with, again, with Haymarket, also academics and unions and activist groups to bring them on book tours. So we have done two rounds of book tours in the last 3 years. And that has been really, really useful, when you bring activists from China to meet with activists here face to face, really made a big impression on the activists here. And that's very, very important. And of course, it's very costly, and we also have to look at the risks to the activists who travel to the United States and give talks, etc., etc. Nevertheless, again, this is something that we'll continue to do, but there's another way. Short of bringing activists from China, we hope to do more public meetings. Where activists and academics based here in the U.S. could speak on China from life mm-hmm. perspectives. So obviously we are doing it right here, but we also want to do it outside of life conferences and bring it to a broad audience, to unions, to activists, community organizers, and to the American public in general. So just to give you one example, in April, Cornell University, essentially Eli Friedman, who was a speaker at this conference some years ago, organized this half-day symposium on the GSX struggle, and they tracked. I think there were around 100 people, and most of the people we did not know. There's some familiar faces, but most of the people who just showed up and wanted to learn about what's happening in China, and that was really important to do that, to not just to do it only at LEF conferences, which are important, but also take the issue out of LEF conferences. Again, because the seriousness of the US-China rivalry, we have to also engage very seriously with the American public. Mm-hmm. In the future, our goal is to do more events like this. We may do another event, something like this, in New York City, but we also want to do it in other cities as well. And we very much hope that you can help us to help make suggestions, coordinate events. And we have a solidarity meeting at 7 o'clock next door. Which room?
Next door, Hyper B.
Okay, B. And so where we want to talk about what sort of things we can do here in the U.S. So if you have any suggestions, ideas, please come to that meeting, even just for 10, 15 minutes, share what you think are important or useful to do. We will obviously welcome to hear what you think. Just to conclude, all those things I listed, we need to continue doing them and doing them better. This once again demands us not to treat US-China rivalry as afterthought, as something that is very distant from us. It should be an issue that is much more prominent for the US left, particularly in the US, but also elsewhere. Again, it's not an issue that is very prominent on the British left, for example. I was just in the UK and been talking to some of the people in the UK, and there, again, very few people are thinking very seriously about China and writing about China. So for this purpose, we're holding the solidarity meeting at 7 o'clock, and we hope to have more discussion about what the left here in the US can do. I look forward to meeting a lot of you up there. Thank you very much.